This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Very good afternoon.
Hello and welcome to the Country Hour. Good to have you along this afternoon, 12:05. And a few of the things that I'm going to be talking to you about this afternoon, and love you to be part of it anytime on the text, 0448 922 604. One of them, should Australia have a grains stock record open to the public? Just so everyone knows, everyone's clear about how much wheat, canola, barley, etc. is stored around Australia. What do you think about that idea? You can let me know this afternoon. And it follows, of course, this shipment of whole grain coming in from Canada to Australia for the first time in years. That'll be delivered to the New South Wales coast in about 4 to 8 weeks' time or so. And also, shortly, work starting on a new wild dog fence in the Esperance area. We'll take you there shortly. But in breaking news this afternoon, a shipment of 56,000 sheep from Fremantle to the Middle East is now in doubt. The sheep are currently at a pre-export quarantine facility just outside of Perth, south of Perth, at Mundajong, and waiting to be trucked to Fremantle, loaded on the MV Ocean Drover, and sent to Kuwait and the UAE. Now, the shipment was scheduled to start loading on Saturday. The exporter, Kuwait Livestock Transport and Trading, trading as Retwa here in Australia, has been advised by the Department of Agriculture that the animal protection organisation, Animals Australia, has made a 400-plus page submission to the department saying it doesn't believe the department should approve a permit to export. The federal department has told the exporter it has until midday tomorrow to respond to Animals Australia's submissions. Rick Wilson is the federal Liberal member for O'Connor. Rick Wilson, why would a letter from Animals Australia hold up this shipment? Because there's still just over a week to go before the three-month moratorium on the trade starts, and the trade is allowed to operate, to export, up until that point.
Well, look, I received information at 9 o'clock last evening from Retwa that they had been advised of this requirement as part of their notice of intention to load, that Animals Australia had made a submission, a 700-page submission. I have flicked through it. Didn't get a lot of sleep last night. It refers to voyages that took place in 2017, and Retwa and the department are requiring Retwa to respond by, I think, lunchtime tomorrow, which I think is quite outrageous that they should give them so little time to respond to such a detailed document. I might make the point, Belinda, that the Ocean Drover, which is about to load, will be loaded under the new allometric formula, which will have a reduction in stocking rates of 28%, and the Almasira, which is currently on the water in the Gulf, by day 15, had 0.123% mortalities, or 78 across the boat for the voyage so far. I mean, these are extraordinary outcomes and have no relation whatsoever to do with the submission that Animals Australia have been allowed to submit by the department, despite the fact that they are currently being investigated by the Federal Police for some of their methods involved in getting the footage that they attained on the Awasi Express.
What is the Department of Agriculture, Water Resources, as it's known, telling you, or have you been in contact with the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud's office, to get an update on proceedings and the implications of this submission made by Animals Australia?
Well, the Minister's office have got back to me, and they've given me an assurance that the permission date will not be changed from Friday the 24th, that there will be a decision made by Friday the 24th. My concern is that, and we've seen this play out before, back in last July, when the department led Emmanuel's Exports to believe that they would receive permission. They asked for them to delay loading for 24 hours. and then withdrew their licence and stranded 65,000 sheep in the Baldivis feedlots. Now, the ramification of that was that those sheep needed to be fed. The pellet market was all sucked into that feedlot. I had farmers calling me saying they couldn't get pellets, and even the raw materials, hay, lupins, barley, were being sucked into that. Now, as we know, Belinda, we haven't had a general break across WA. There is, even if we get a good rain and there's nothing in sight, it's going to be a very slow feed season. We simply cannot allow this 56,000 sheep to be stranded in a feedlot consuming supplementary feed that may well be needed for the sheep that are left here.
What if this drama rolls on and on and we eventually get to the point where we hit the 1st of June, which is the start of the three-month moratorium on the trade during those peak heat and humidity conditions in the Northern Hemisphere summer? What happens at this point if it's delayed up until that point? Does the shipment not go at all?
Well, the regulations clearly state that a ship cannot leave after the 1st of June, and there is no doubt that Animals Australia, and I believe that people within the department that are continuing their vendetta against the live export trade, that is their absolute goal, to delay the departure of this boat until after the 1st of June.
So there'll be no extension to that, even though this shipment was scheduled to be loaded this weekend?
Look, I'm not sure what discretion the minister has. I will certainly be asking that question of him when I speak to him. But there is no doubt that this is what this tactic is all about.
Is there a concern about the legal implications of not following up Animals Australia's concerns as detailed in that several hundred page submission to the Department of Agriculture?
That is my belief, that they've given RETWA a day and a half to respond, thereby giving themselves the opportunity to say, well, the response is not sufficient, therefore we're not going to issue a licence. That is certainly a concern that I have, and certainly RETWA, who've got a day and a half to respond to a 700-page document, have.
Are you confident this shipment is going to proceed? Is there a way around what's going on behind the scenes within the department and this submission from Animals Australia? Can Western Australia take this issue into its own hands?
Well, look, my preference would certainly to work through the Minister's office to make sure that we get a satisfactory resolution here. I have had farmers ring me this morning who have sort of indicated that they would be prepared to get off the tractors, go to Fremantle to help load this boat and throw the ropes and deal with the legal ramifications later on. That is the strength of feeling around what is going on here.
ABC WA, this is The Country Hour. I'm Belinda Varaschetti and catching up with Rick Wilson, the federal member for O'Connor this afternoon. And Rick Wilson, I have to ask you about your relationship, I guess, with the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, or at this stage anyway, he's still the Agriculture Minister as far as I'm aware. Are you at loggerheads with him? I mean, you're prepared to come on and discuss this on The Country Hour today rather than working behind the scenes to with his office to get this shipment out of Fremantle.
Look, I wouldn't say that I'm at loggerheads with the minister. I mean, he's had to make some tough decisions around the live export trade and how it continues to operate on a sustainable basis. And
how do you rate that performance?
Well, look, I think that some of those measures are paying off very well. And as I mentioned, we've had some extraordinary successful voyages since the trade resumed in November. And so all credit to the minister. There are some issues, around stocking densities and what months those allometric formulas are implemented. There are also some issues around the double-tiered ships that I think we need to address as a government once we get back to Canberra, because if we don't address those issues, it's going to make it very difficult for the trade to operate sustainably in the long term. So, while I think the minister's done a very good job in terms of making some changes that's cleaned up the industry, and we've got some good results in terms of the mortalities and the animal welfare outcomes, the exporters have still got to make a profit and they've still got to have a viable business. So I think we need to do some more work there.
Would you like to be the Agriculture Minister?
I'd love to be, but it'll never happen while we're in a coalition with the National Party. That is a portfolio that they, obviously prize very highly, and that'll be a discussion between the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister. But if I was called to serve in that role, I would be very, very pleased.
Well, the portfolios haven't been settled at this point anyway. Would you like David Littleproud to continue as the Agriculture Minister?
Oh, look... that is really a decision for, the Prime Minister and the Deputy
That's
Prime Minister.
That's true, but you'd have a preference, wouldn't you?
Look, I'm prepared to work with whoever is the Minister for Agriculture. I think that, everybody in the coalition who's operated in that portfolio, Barnaby Joyce as well, has done their very best to put Australian agriculture front and centre. And I think
would you prefer Barnaby Joyce as agriculture minister?
Well, as I say, it's not my decision, and but I know Barnaby has been a very, very strong supporter and advocate for the live export trade, and I was very proud to have him standing alongside me at the Katanning meeting last year when, you know, 1,000 growers turned up, and Barnaby was certainly a rock star at that particular event.
So from now back to the issue of this 56,000 sheep, what's the, I mean, the company's got, what, 48 hours or so since they got the documentation to answer the concerns of Animals Australia?
Well, that's my concern. I mean, this has been sprung on them at the last minute. They're obviously very busy preparing, you know, the sheep and the logistics to get those sheep loaded on the boat. Now they have been given a 700-page document to respond to. And if the response is not considered adequate by the department, then they will see that as fair grounds to withhold the permission to load the boat. So the next 48 hours is going to be very critical for the West Australian livestock industry, the sheep industry in particular. And, you know, I will be watching very, very closely. And as I say, I've had contact this morning for some very irate farmers who are very motivated to effectively take matters into their own hands if they see fit.
Rick Wilson, good to have you on the Country Hour. Thank you for that.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Belinda.
Rick Wilson, who is the federal member for O'Connor, talking about that shipment of 56,000 sheep from Fremantle, destined for the Middle East, now in doubt. That shipment now in doubt. The sheep are at a pre-export quarantine facility just south of Perth, expected to be loaded on the Ocean Drover this Saturday, but stalled at this point after Animals Australia made a several hundred page submission to the Department of Agriculture, and the department's been in touch with the exporter and saying it has until midday tomorrow to respond to Animals Australia's submission. It is 17 past 12 here on the Country Hour.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
Well, it's taken almost 20 years of lobbying by farmers, but today the first post of a new wild dog fence in Western Australia was driven into the ground. The 660-kilometre fence is an extension of the existing 1,170-kilometre dog barrier fence, which starts north of Kalbarri in the state's north and then finishes just around about Ravensthorpe. And after years of wrangling over who would pay for the fence and clearing environmental hurdles, the $11 million fence started to roll out. Max Seema is a full-time dogger in the region working for the Esperance Biosecurity Group and the Southern Biosecurity Group.
I cover an area between, like, say, Lake King, Hopetown, Esperance, and up to the top of Samingums, to the top of the Esperance Shire boundary. And, recently there's been quite a steady influx of dogs coming from the north since it's been so dry. Some of them have been pretty hard to beat, but we're slowly getting on top of them.
Yeah, I talked to a grower just over here before, and she said they have had about 5 caught on their boundary fence. Is that unusual, or is that higher than normal?
That was a funny one, that. The dogs had sort of taken up resident in a lone patch of bush, sort of with no entry or exit to it, in the middle of a heap of farm properties. And once we sort of found out they were in there, it became quite a simple task to remove them and to get in there. It worked out to be well. We ended up getting 7 dogs out of that one area, so over a 5-6 month period, so that's pretty good effort, and save them a lot of heartache as well.
How do you control the dogs? What sort of methods do you use?
We do a lot of baiting using 1080 baits and a lot of trapping as well. Trapping seems to be quite the way to get them. The traps do the work while you're not there when they're in the ground. And also, if you get the opportunity, we'll try and use a rifle and shoot them as well. If you get the chance, a lot of the time you never see them.
Yeah, and they're pretty sneaky from what I understand. Now, we're here today to start the extension to the state barrier fence at the back of Ravensthorpe that eventually will be an extra 660 kilometres and go to the back of or the east of Esperance. How effective is a barrier fence in tackling the wild dog problem?
Oh, it's crucial. The fence is going to allow us so much, especially for the eastern Ravensthorpe through to the whole top of Esperance. Just gives us something to work off at the moment. You sort of, you know, you work off a couple of farmers' boundaries that have got vermin-proof fencing, and it makes it quite easy. But this fence is going to funnel the dogs along the fence and gives us a great opportunity to trap along it and perform our work. So yeah.
So it's just another way of trying to control dogs out in the bush.
Oh, it's going to be so good. I'd say we'd be seeing a reduction in the dog numbers quite significantly in the farming areas, and it gives us something to work off, which is going to be vital to slowly get on top of them. It gives us a chance to work the inside a bit harder and save the ones that are into the sheep at the moment as well. So.
Now, one of the reasons this is getting built is obviously to protect the livestock that's on farms. But what about native populations? The dogs must have a good go at some of the native animals when they're out in the bush.
Yeah, definitely. Wallaby seem to be a big sufferer. A lot of the marsupials, there's quite an array of little marsupials. There's bilbies, I think there's even quackers, chooditches. Like there's a larger number that seem to come to dogs, and you can see that when you look in their dog scats. You can see what they've been eating. A lot of lizards. They do give the kangaroos a hard time as well, so hopefully it slows everything down because we can get in there and get the dogs out.
Maxima is a full-time dogger working in the Esperance region, talking to Emma Field as the work finally gets started on that little bit of the fence, the 660-kilometre fence, an extension to the existing dog barrier fence. ABC WA 21 past 12. And if you're wondering about how much time, sweat, money goes into building new fences, then stay listening, because after the news and weather, you're going to hear from Mel Thompson. Remember Mel? Exactly 1 year ago, a fire ripped through his farm near Albany, killing almost 500 sheep, taking out pastures and also kilometres of fences.
Peter on the back of the truck just started yelling about get out of there, because as I saw, as soon as he started yelling, I looked in the rear vision mirror and the fire had broken through the smoke and it was probably about 100 metres behind us.
That's after news headlines and the weather here on the Country Hour, 22 past 12. In some mining news today, an historic underground nickel mine at Kambalda has just sold. Mincor Resources has bought the Long Nickel Mine in a cash and shares deal worth $9.5 million. Looks like there is fresh confidence in the nickel industry. The Long Nickel Mine first started production back in 1979, but it's been shut since June last year. Mincor owns another deposit called Durkin North that's only 1.2 kilometres from the underground infrastructure at Long, so a stone's throw away. This is the second Kambalda nickel mine to sell in the last 9 months. Last September, American company Black Mountain Metals bought the mothballed Lanfranchi nickel mine for $15 million. And in some grain news, before we get to the headlines today, if you've been watching world grain prices slump in recent months, you might be happy to hear a market analyst thinks they've probably hit rock bottom, for now at least. At the start of this year, wheat from Kwinana in WA was fetching about $400 a tonne. The price is now around $280. Grain market analyst Malcolm Bartholomaeus thinks the market has simply been correcting itself from prices that were probably too high.
The wheat price around Australia was being driven by the need to move wheat from west, from South Australia and Western Australia, over to the eastern states. And the eastern states had to set a price that was well above the world price, world export parity, to get that market mechanism working. It probably overshot a little to the point where wheat prices all around Australia were well above export parity. Now, at the same time, I think some grain was moving out of Western Australia and possibly into export markets at lower than grain than the price that grain was being shipped around to the eastern states. But eventually the market has worked to push prices in South Australia and Western Australia down to levels that equate to export parity, just to get that balance in the market between shifting grain into the domestic market and getting enough being exported, so that the overall balance sheet remains balanced. Now, there is a view that possibly too much grain has been exported out of Western Australia, and that may come home to roost later in the year before the next 2019 harvest gets underway. So the market isn't perfect. They may well have overshot to the downside for a little while. But effectively, what we've seen is wheat prices move from an inflated level basically down towards where current export parity is.
Is there not still that demand from over east, though?
Yeah, there's demand over east, but the price that someone wanting to secure the grain to move to the east should effectively be the export parity price at Kwinana plus a small margin to make it worthwhile someone selling into that domestic market. So I think the premiums being paid in both South Australia and Western Australia were a little bit higher than they probably needed to during the period of peak demand. And a lot of grain did move to the east coast as a consequence. Now the balance has moved back the other way, where the prices need to be a little bit more reflective of export parity levels.
You mentioned there had been some suggestion that we'd been exporting too much. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are people that are looking at the balance sheet for Australia and seeing the amount of grain that has been shipped into export markets versus what they think the total supply of grain is, and then looking at what they see the current supply of grain on the East Coast is and what demand will be through to the end of the year. And they remain convinced that before we get to next harvest, the supply is going to be very tight, primarily because they think that a little bit more has been sent offshore than probably was justified.
And so will that see the price lift a little bit more then in the next few months?
If they are correct, they see that the balance sheet has tightened more than it should have.
Mm. We have just had our first shipping import of milling grain for quite a while. Did that have, into Australia that is, did that have an impact on the market at all?
Look, I think psychologically it probably has, but from a material point of view, looking at the balance sheet, it probably shouldn't make much difference in the long run. But I think the fact that it was possible for someone to make the decision to ship grain into Australia from Canada is indicative that the Australian market was a little bit too overheated.
Now, it was corn and sorghum that was imported, you know, milling grain, as I say. But if feed was to be imported, do you think that would have an impact on the market?
Yeah, if feed grains come into the market, when we've seen it in the past, I think a number of years ago, some feed wheat came into the Melbourne market, and that basically just put a lid on the market. Look, at this stage, I don't think there would be too much reason for more grain to be imported into Australia. The anecdotal evidence is that, you know, there is still grain around. It's just a matter of whether the market works efficiently enough to make sure the grain goes where it needs to be. So I think grower reluctance to sell, and as we move through the year, there should be a little bit more upside on prices from where they are right now.
And speaking about upside as well, or at least upside for exporters, the Australian dollar has softened a little bit over the last few days. It's now at 68.86 at last I checked to the US dollar. Why is that?
There's some uncertainty, of course, going into the election process. But we also saw some weak employment figures come out during last week, and that pushed the Australian dollar down. The expectation would be that we would need an interest rate cut. And in fact, yesterday the Reserve Bank came out with some statements indicating that they would be looking very closely at cutting interest rates in June, with potentially a second cut possibly in August or September. The Australian dollar, it's really a story about Australian interest rates and the strength of the Australian economy. That in turn is feeding into some of the positive upward moves we are seeing in the Australian grain market as well.
Is that likely to continue softening, or do you think it's reached a base, it's reacted to the news, it's where it is now?
Look, I think it's reacted to the news. It'll what generally happens is that it goes down. As people come to the conclusion that interest rates are under pressure, it will drift around in the absence of any new data, probably drift up a little. Then when we do get the interest rate cut, we would probably see the dollar come off a little bit more and go through the cycle again.
Well, I guess just consider, you know, as you mentioned, how closely linked the Australian dollar is with our grain markets as well. When do you think would be the best time for grain growers, to be locking in their prices?
Well, the last 5 years has been a pretty constant pattern. We've seen the Chicago Board of Trade futures move up during May and June, And in fact, we often see the market bottom out in March, which it did this year. It revisited that low and went a fraction lower just the other day. But the move, the upward move from those lows set early in the calendar year have been quite dramatic. You know, 5,200 US cents a bushel is what we've been seeing over the last few years. So in the last 5 years, we have enjoyed a rally in the market during May and June, and we are currently in one of those rallies right now. What we don't know is whether there is enough to keep that rally extending, but probably we would expect the market to become a little circumspect about further gains as we get into June, and particularly towards the end of June. So we probably are looking at a 5 or 6 week window of opportunity where, if we are going to get an opportunity to capture higher prices, the probability is that it will be within that 5 to 6 week window.
Grain market analyst Malcolm Bartholomaeus with Tyne Logan talking about grain prices, and also mentioned the recent decision to give Manildra the green light to import some high protein wheat into Eastern Australia. You'll learn more about that after the weather, because it's not just Andrew Wiedemann from Grain Producers Australia who's suggesting Australia needs a transparent grain stock disclosure system. So I'm keen to hear what you think about that suggestion too. 0448 922 604. We'll get into that discussion shortly. First, at 29 to 1, Michaela Carr in the studio. What's happening in the headlines, Michaela?
Hi, Belinda. A 20-year-old woman has pleaded guilty to murdering her baby daughter at the family's home in Capel in the southwest. Cassandra Rose Doohan had been due to stand trial next month over the death of four-month-old Anastasia Hand, who died in hospital in May 2017 after being found unresponsive in her cot. However, today Doohan appeared in the Supreme Court in Perth and pleaded guilty to murdering her child. Labor frontbencher Jim Chalmers will not contest the party leadership, leaving Anthony Albanese as the only declared candidate. Mr. Chalmers says he's been genuinely surprised by the support and encouragement he's received from his colleagues. An online bikini store has been fined $30,000 in the Perth Magistrates Court for misleading customers. The website for Frankie Swim stated it did not offer refunds and that customers had to pay postage on returns themselves. Consumer Protection says no refund policies are illegal. And in football, Essendon forward Joe Danaher will miss the rest of the AFL season. The 25-year-old is dealing with a groin injury and is likely to need surgery. Belinda, I'll be back with more news at 1 o'clock because I'm so nice.
You are so nice.
Like
unlike
are.
Me. One text saying, what was it? I am a very rude interviewer.
There's nothing wrong with being assertive, Belle.
Thank you, Michaela. You can go now.
Thank
Get
you.
Out. Bye-bye. 27 to 1.
You're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Talking more about grains shortly, and keen to know what you think about a grain stock record that's open to the public. You like that idea? You don't like that idea? Let me know. And off to Mount Barker to get the results of the cattle market just before the news at 1. Right now, it is time to head to the Weather Bureau. Matt Bodehoven on deck today. Is there much to talk about in northern and eastern parts, Matt?
No, not a lot to talk about, Belinda, unfortunately. Have been some warm temperatures around the western Kimberley coastal areas around Broome. Quite a few days over 35 degrees up through there. And they'll continue there into Friday. But mostly sunny conditions generally over the next 4 days for the outback districts, apart from a little bit of coastal shower activity around the Euclid Coast on the weekend and into Monday.
All right, well, let's move into the Southwest Land Division. I don't think we're going to hear the news that we really want to hear about some rain, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, that is very unfortunate, and expected to continue for probably a week or even up to 10 days. There's a hint of a cold front trying to approach, but it'll weaken as it gets close to the Southwest Land Division. But over the next 4 days, on Friday we'll have a weak cold front to brush the south coast during the evening. So we'll see some showers in the south coastal and the southeast coastal districts, also through the southwest and adjacent lower west and great southern. Rainfall up to 3 millimetres around the western south coast, but a lot of rainfall figures further inland. On Saturday, the weak cold front will contract into the Bight, and a ridge of high pressure will develop in the wake of the cold front near the south coast. Showers over the southwest district, south coastal and southeast coastal districts. Rainfall quite light, less than 1 millimetre. on Sunday and Monday, the pattern's going to be the same. So a ridge of high pressure will continue over southern parts of the southwest land division, mainly through the Great Southern District there. And because of that ridge, we'll see some morning frosts in susceptible areas through the Great Southern and the Central Wheat Belt, and also in the adjacent parts of the southwest and south coastal districts. Light shower activity along the south coast, east of Walpole, but rainfall figures less than 1 millimetre.
And warnings this afternoon?
We've got a strong wind warning for the Albany coast, and also a strong fire weather warning for the Eucla district today, with some fresh northerly winds through there.
Thank you for the update, Matt. Appreciate that. 25 to 1 here on the Country Hour. No rainfall around Western Australia, over 5 millimetres in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. I'm sure you're well aware of that. Should Australia have a grain stocks record that's open to the public? Some people in WA don't want one. Are you one of those? In a moment, you'll hear why in a moment, but I'm keen to know what you think about that. So the text 0448 922 604 is the text number. And the reason this is being talked about again is because just recently, New South Wales-based flour milling company Manildra managed to get the green light to import some high-protein wheat from Canada. Now, the company says it did so because it couldn't access enough of that particular type of wheat from the domestic sources. And you might have seen a Stop Wheat Imports campaign that's been started, with some farmers saying they have real biosecurity concerns around this. Grain market analyst Mark Martin thinks all grain introduced into Australia poses some sort of biosecurity risk. So he thinks it's time the government created a transparent stock reporting system.
At this stage, the grain stocks in this country are very elastic. A very elastic thing, and the measurement of it is very poor. That knowledge in itself would help the management put the consumers of grain, as well as the growers of grain, in a much more informed position. At the moment, we do have enough grain to look after most of our consumers. It's just in the Manildra case, we don't have enough high-protein grain. Western Australia ran into problems, and they're not going to supply us next year, and we've still got a drought. Mike, it's a whole different ballgame.
So does this take us back to the single desk regime?
Interesting you say that. The single desk regime actually began after the 1930s with what the US did to protect their farmers. I don't know whether we'd go back to the single desk, but what it would need is the government to intervene and implement policies that would ensure that our industries are protected. And those could be a grain reserve that is managed by the taxpayer, by the government, and also a much better reporting mechanism on the grain stocks in this country.
Has this critical situation impacted on the grain trading companies?
Big time, Mike. We're up to seven. Seven grain trading companies have already gone into liquidation, mainly as a result of the drought. We saw GrainCorp just recently reported that they've lost $50 million, and that's, again, as a result of the drought. So it's certainly pressuring not just the farmers, but also the other end of the industry. Look, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see a processor or two also get into strife, especially if this drought does continue. I would say that they would owe farmers in excess of $20 million combined.
Grains analyst Mark Martin speaking to Mike Pritchard. And the Manildra Group has said publicly that it supports the efforts of grain grower groups to introduce a transparent stock reporting system. It says it would better inform supply and demand decisions by growers and farmers. Now, Jack on the text doesn't agree with that. He says, don't give stock information away. We're part of a corrupted global grain market. Don't give away any competitive advantage we have. And I think the PGA would pretty much agree with this. As you'd imagine, the WA-based Pastoralists and Graziers Association doesn't agree with the analysts' assessment of things, Mark Martin, you heard from just moments ago. It does not want a compulsory grain stocks information reporting system here in Australia. PGA's Western Grain Growers Chair, Gary McGill, says it wouldn't benefit WA because most of our grain is exported.
Our stocks information is well known. Almost all of it's held in the big bulk handling system. And so we think it would be disadvantageous to us as growers if we were handing out that information freely to our international market. Notwithstanding that the international market, I'm sure, has a good understanding of what we do in Australia and in Western Australia.
Why would it be a disadvantage, Gary?
Well, they would get to see in finer detail what the stock situation is. That would affect their the way they might consider their bids and their pricing and those sorts of things. Market conditions around the world are important for everybody, buyers and sellers, and we think that everybody has a fair understanding of it anyway. Certainly the growers do in WA.
Internationally though, Gary, the US and Canada disclose stocks. I'm unsure about Russia, but the amount of grain that Australia produces, even in comparison to the US and Canada, it's small. So hasn't the global market already moved past this argument that you're saying here, that essentially we'd be showing our hand?
Maybe so, but why contribute to it? We just don't understand the argument, and we note that a fair few of the other West Australian growers believe the same thing, because CBH have done some work to ascertain this, and it's pretty clear, and so have we, it's pretty clear that the growers are not interested in having a mandatory disclosure. If anybody wishes to, and I might add, CBH, I understand CBH is providing information to our government, to organisations, if they need it, then that's the appropriate way to go forward.
If we look at the global landscape, it is dominated by some countries, or some companies, I should say. Glencore, that's the world's largest commodities trader. They would have a pretty good understanding as to what grain is where internationally, yet farmers don't have that information. And there is an argument that if the system was more transparent, farmers could use that to make decisions around crop planting and also around whether or not to hold grain that they might have for sale. How do you respond to those arguments?
Joe, I would find it I assert that it's highly contestable. The grower of Western Australia, I can't speak for the other states, but the grower of Western Australia, all the ones I talk to, are supported in Western Australia by an extensive grain marketing and consultancy regime here of all different types, and there is significant understanding and information about what is going on, not only in Australia with stocks and plantings and production in other parts of the world, to allow the West Australian farmer who's exposed to the international market to make good planting and other marketing decisions. I dispute that assertion.
And what about disclosing demand information? So information being made more available, say, weekly when grain over a certain amount of tonnes is sold, rather than the current arrangement of it being disclosed when it's shipped, which could be, you know, 12 months after it's been sold. Would you support more information there at all?
Well, if in Western Australia the bulk handler is, of course, primarily responsible for all the shipping arrangements, I'm not completely familiar with how regular that they disclose and disclose who to. But we would want to have our reservations about how much is disclosed and when, particularly if it's mandated.
Are you concerned at all about biosecurity? We heard some concerns flagged about wheat coming in from overseas. Might it bring in a pest or a disease that we don't have here? Does that concern you?
No, I'm not concerned. I actually have some confidence in our biosecurity arrangements. I think they are rigorous and well-established. And my understanding that this particular arrangement has met all the biosecurity requirements and protocols, and I expect that it will do so. I think we have a rigorous biosecurity scenario in Australia, so I'm not alarmed about that. I think sometimes people use the question about biosecurity just to give support to their argument of fundamental opposition to such a course of action.
If there are requests to bring in grain from overseas that is for feed, would you oppose it?
Yes, we would. We would be expressing our concern and gravest reservation, given that there's an excess of feed wheat in Western Australia, and we know already that possibly in the order of a couple of million tonnes has already gone around to the eastern seaboard to satisfy their feed wheat requirements. So, if there was some feed wheat type quality coming in from somewhere overseas, we would be wondering why that would need to happen.
Pastoralists and Graziers, Western Grain Growers Chair Gary McGill with Joe Prendergast. The Department of Agriculture and Water Resources has told us it is assessing 11 applications to import bulk grain into Australia. The applications apply to canola, wheat, corn and sorghum. On the text, Tom in Benue has sent this through. Grain stocks information is one of the few marketing advantages we have. We must play this card very close to our chests. That information belongs to the growers, particularly here in Western Australia.
It is 16 to 1. Well, it's been a year since the Stirling Range fires devastated farms in the South Stirling area, just near Albany. Unfortunately, prescribed burns carried out by the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions breached containment lines, taking out more than 17,000 hectares of farmland. Now, you might remember hearing on the Country Hour at the time Mel Thompson's story. He lost 460 pregnant ewes, 30 hectares of crop, 70 hectares of pasture, and 60 hectares of plantation. John Daly visited his farm on the anniversary of the day he narrowly escaped death.
When the fire came through, it was just like a ball of flame, basically, just travelling. It was just an orange glow. And you could just see it moving. And the dust, the stubble, the smoke was just swirling in front of the truck and around the truck. You couldn't see anything. All you could hear was the noise of the wind. You couldn't really hear the fire. I've been to fires and you usually hear the roar of the fire, but you couldn't hear that. It was just a deafening wind and fear, really.
12 months, almost to the day. How does it feel to hear that audio?
Yeah, I haven't heard it for a while. Brings back some raw memories. But as I said, I actually didn't think it would affect me as much as it has just listening to it. But yeah, a year's a long time, but when you think back sometimes it doesn't seem that long ago. When I did that interview a year ago, there was a lot I didn't actually understand at the time. It's probably taken the next few months for things to sink in. One, on how lucky we were, and two, what your mind does and the games it plays with you over the weeks and months afterwards. I didn't realise at the time that I actually lost about half an hour to three quarters of an hour of memory, where I don't remember what happened. And it wasn't until I spoke to people in the days and weeks after that they sort of explained that I was talking to them and I don't remember any of that, which really shocked me a bit. It's not so much shock. Your mind just switches off, apparently, and you just go into survival mode, where all you're doing is trying to survive and nothing else matters. So what you got here, you can see the regrowth on the blue gums up the laneway, which is good. On the right here, we've got...
Beeps at you.
Bloody seatbelts. On the right, you've got the Tagasasi were there, but we had to push all them over. They got taken out. We've got a new fence going up. Got another one on the left that has to go up. But getting there.
When all was said and done, what was the bill, once you got all these fences up?
The fencing alone came to probably $250,000 worth of fencing in damages. I think there was just over 30 kilometres worth. We've put up, I think, 16, 17 Ks. But it's just not putting up the fences. It's clearing the dead trees, off the old fences, and then rolling up the old fences and pushing it all out of the way and cleaning it all up. We're at the back of Beulah Downs on the edge of the Stirling National Park, directly south of Bluff Knoll, you could say. And in relation to the fire probably started 100 metres to my right, or to the west. Was the first spot fire, and then directly in front of us, just over the creek where we can see in front of us, is where the main fire started in the barley stubble, which, as I said back a year ago, it just exploded, and there was no way of stopping it at that stage.
To describe the scene, there is a lot of dead trees, almost petrified by the fire. But there is some regrowth, some green shoots starting to appear, and I guess that's maybe a good metaphor for what's happened on the farm in the last 12 months.
Certainly is. Took a while for the shoots to actually reappear. We thought there for a while that All the trees had actually died, but yeah, come spring, summer, as you said, there's a lot of new growth everywhere, and that's probably, as you said, a metaphor for starting again. Where this time last year, I think we were probably two-thirds of the way through the program, and then half of that probably had to be reseeded again, some through fire, some through just wind erosion. I think we finished on the 18th of August last year after reseeding some paddocks up to two times. So this year it's just been a luxury not having to feed sheep. I think we finished feeding sheep at September sometime last year. This year we've got that much feed we don't know what to do with.
Have you had any luck with compensation claims through the DBCA that really started the fire through prescribed burns that ended up causing significant damage to your property?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of uninsured parts of the damage. You have got loss of topsoils, you've got loss of shelter belts, you've got bits that I have insured but probably haven't insured to the amount I needed to have it insured to, because I just didn't expect to have that much damage done. So we did have a class action go to DBCA, of which it sounded like it was going pretty good, and we were hoping for a quick settlement, but then got a letter about 2 months ago stating that no state or person under the state is liable for any damage incurred by fire. So
was that a surprise?
Yeah, it was a huge surprise to all of us. So we've got solicitors looking at it now and to see if it's worth fighting for. We're looking into that to see if we have got any compensation. Otherwise, we're just going to grin and bear it, I suppose, and move on.
South Stirling farmer Mel Thompson with John Daly, talking about the fire that ripped through his farm near Albany this time last year. And just taking a closer look at the compensation claim that Mel was just telling you about. 4 years ago, the state government amended the Conservation and Land Management Act, and it added a section which protects the state government from any civil liability for activities like prescribed burns, even if it's in the wrong. In a statement, a department spokesperson says it has not accepted liability for damage caused by the fire near Bluff Knoll last year. It says a thorough review found the burns were in accordance with policies, procedures and were commenced in suitable conditions. Environment Minister Stephen Dawson agreed with that assessment and also said there were no plans to review those amendments made in 2015. He also says he takes safety very seriously and remain committed to prescribed burning as a key measure to protecting the community. 7:07, we'll get to markets shortly. Right now, I want to take you over the border to the Northern Territory, where there's been some big property news in the northern cattle industry this week, with the sale of a station near Darwin to a Malaysian state-owned corporation. Dan Fitzgerald is from the NT Country Hour and is here with the details for you. Dan, what's the station and who's bought it?
G'day there, Bill. The station is called Carmore Plains. It's about 200 k's to the east of Darwin, and it sits on the floodplains, floodplain country, and it backs onto the Van Diemen Gulf. So it's around 41,000 hectares, which in territory size is a pretty relatively small sort of block. And about half of that is, yeah, these big marine and freshwater floodplains, which is just green grass sort of as far as the eye can see. There's a lot of buffalo on this country. There's around 2,500 head of buffalo came with it. Lots of pigs and wildlife. And the property is more well known in the territory as a bit of a hunting and wildlife place. A lot of big game hunters came from overseas to shoot those buffalo and the boar and that sort of thing. It was bought by a Malaysian state-owned investment arm. It's called the Sarawak Economic Development Corporation. And they have been in the territory cattle game for quite some time, Bill. They actually own Rosewood Station, which is just over the NT border from Kununurra. They've owned that property since about 1982. And yeah, they forked out $20 million for Carmore Plains.
So what are the new owners' plans for this property?
Well, as we understand it, they plan to take their Brahman cattle from Rosewood Station, truck them up to Carmore Plains and put them out on those green floodplains during the dry season, where they'll fatten up and background them before exporting the cattle overseas. And the Malaysians, they do also have a bit of an interest in the buffalo, I understand, for export as well and domestication over in Malaysia.
And what about that sale price, $20 million? Is that a big price for a property like Carmore Plains?
Yes, certainly from the people in the industry that I've been speaking with this week, a few expressed quite some surprise that Carmore Plains sold for $20 million. It's a big price tag for such a small place. It does have a lot of good grass on it. But yeah, a few people expressed to me this week that they might find it hard to get a good return off such a large price tag. I can tell you that the last time the property sold back in 2001, it sold for just $2.8 million. So that's a big jump in that time period.
And did the sale need approval from the Foreign Investment Review Board?
Well, ordinarily, if a property is over, I think it's $14 million, it would need approval. But I understand it was bought by a subsidiary of the Malaysian company, which is a subsidiary based in Australia. So I think, as far as I understand it, they've kind of got around it a little bit there.
And Dan, the really interesting part of this sale is what is inside the homestead, in the foyer of the homestead. A couple of interesting skulls there, a triceratops and a T-Rex skull. Now, were these part of the sale?
Yeah, Belle, you had a pretty interesting homestead there. It was a bit of a sort of an attraction for all the hunters and shooters who'd come through. And yeah, as I understand it, there were these like huge triceratops and T-Rex skulls. They weren't the real deal, but they were museum quality replicas. I've seen a few pics of them. They're quite impressive, but they didn't go with the sale. The family who owned the property previously, they've taken them with them back to their place in Queensland.
Oh, that would have been an extra $20 million on top of the sale, I imagine, Dan.
Yes. And also forgot to mention that business, the hunting and a safari business, they actually had one of the few licenses to harvest crocodiles for their skulls and skin. So, but that also didn't come with the sale.
Dan, thank you so much. Good to have you on the WA Country Hour.
No worries.
Dan Fitzgerald reporting from the Northern Territory. 3 minutes to one. Let's get to the markets and have a look at today's yarding of cattle at Mount Barker, which was almost the same size as last week. Tracy Barker is there for you. What were the prices like, Tracy?
A contrast to last week, with almost all categories gaining on demand. The yarding was dominated by weaner heifer calves, presented in mainly stall condition, reaching a top of 264 cents, while the best weaner steers reached 296 cents a kilo. Heavy cows were up again this week, selling to a top of 218 cents. Bullocks over 750 kilos sold for 212 cents and 234 cents for weights between 600 and 750. Grown steers weighing between 5 and 600 kilos sold for 216 to 220 cents, while the lighter under 500 kilo steers made 282 cents a kilo. Heifers over 540 kilos gained 26 cents, making from 220 to 256 cents, averaging 229 cents a kilo. The yearlings fluctuated on quality, with steers selling for 250 to 276 cents, and the yearling heifers made from 204 to 254 cents to average 225 cents a kilo. Heavyweight weaner steers sold from 258 to 292 cents. Medium weight steers between 280 and 330 kilos sold for 240 to 296 cents, while the lighter weight sold for 240 to 280 cents to average 270 cents a kilo. The heavyweight weaner heifers gained 15 cents, making from 230 to 254 cents, while the lighter heifers sold for 190 to 254 cents to average 230 cents a kilo. Heavy prime cows made from 200 to 218 cents, averaging 209 cents a kilo. Medium weight cows sold from 196 to 198 cents, while boners gained 9 cents, selling for 140 to 198 cents to average 179 cents a kilo. The prime heavy bulls were up 10 cents to sell from 196 to 228 cents. Medium weight bulls sold for 190 to 198 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for those details, Tracy. And just repeating the breaking news this afternoon, a shipment of 56,000 sheep from Fremantle to the Middle East is now in doubt. They were meant to be loaded on Saturday, but Animals Australia has made a submission to the Federal Department of Agriculture, and now the department has been in touch with the exporter and says it's got 48 hours to respond to what Animals Australia, what's in that submission from Animals Australia. Peter says, I may be too late with this, but I'd like to know why the whole world stops because of Animals Australia. Surely they're just another lobby group. ABC WA, time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.